It's 4:06. You're listening to Central Time here on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. I'm Rob Ferret. My co-host Veronica Rickert is out today. Coming up later, our guest says a debate over civil service exams in the state has unfairly maligned restaurant workers. First, new proposed legislation in the state could make Wisconsin's great outdoors a lot more affordable for a group of state residents. The bill would provide all fourth grade students and their families with free admission to Wisconsin state parks. The author of that bill, Melissa Sargent, joins us now. She's a Democratic state representative from Madison. Representative Sargent, thanks for joining us today.
Thanks for having me.
Well, why are you introducing this legislation?
Well, I know that when we bring our kids out into our natural areas, that we are planting the seeds that will carry on with them through their lifelines, the legacy of our public lands. And it's really something that runs deep in our heritage across Wisconsin. I know that I, as a mom of four, that our family is happiest and my children are happiest when we're outside. And that's a gift that, as a legislature, I would hope we would want to give to every child.
Big picture, what do you see as the value of our state parks here in Wisconsin?
I don't think you can put a dollar amount on it. They're invaluable. It is something that when people think of Wisconsin, our parks and open spaces is one of the first things that pops into people's minds.
You mentioned your family, your kids. Could you talk about some of your own experiences bringing your family to the state parks here in the state?
Well, definitely my two older boys are certified scuba divers, and they certainly enjoy going up to Devil's Lake and spending time underwater and observing the world from that angle. And my younger boys enjoy it when we go up there because they can play on the beaches and explore the rocks. And, you know, we are in a world where more and more children are spending time inside, and the statistics are startling. And we need to figure out how it is that we can instill a healthy ethic in our children as well as the importance of conservation.
I didn't know people scuba dived in Devil's Lake.
Absolutely. Absolutely.
We're talking to Melissa Sargent, Assembly Representative from Madison, about legislation that would provide free state park passes to fourth graders and their families. And Representative Sargent, why fourth graders in particular?
Well, there was a recent initiative introduced by the president that provided passes to fourth grade students to the national parks. So I thought, what a great idea. Seeing that Wisconsin is the first state to have state parks, why don't we do that here?
Do you see this as something that could expand to other ages as well?
You know, I am definitely would love to see every child spend time in our state parks and our county parks and our city parks and our national parks for that matter. But I do know that we have some economic limitations on what it is that we can provide. Knowing that, I was sensitive to the fiscal impacts and believe that this is something that we can do to plant that seed and support the economies around our parks. And probably next year, if this bill were to pass, families would buy their own passes because they would see the value of it.
Yeah, I want to stay with the financial side there. The state park system is in some ways in a tougher place than a year ago. Do you worry about maybe taking revenue away from those parks at a tough time?
Well, you know, I have reached out to the Fiscal Bureau and definitely been cognizant of that. We anticipate that if this bill was to pass, that probably about 10% of the families of fourth graders would actually take us up on it. It's about $230,000 a year to make this happen. I think the health benefits, the benefits to the small mom-and-pop shops around the state parks, and planting the seed of conservation in our students is well worth that investment.
Yeah, do you see this as a possible benefit for tourism within the state as people maybe check out state parks that they might not otherwise have done?
Absolutely. Absolutely. You'll get out of your normal path and go out and explore some of the wonders that aren't in where you normally stomp.
Now, despite the introduction of some higher camping fees, the parks are seeing a record number of campers this year. That could go up some unseasonably nice weather late in the year. So maybe these fees aren't a big hurdle for potential visitors and campers to those parks?
Well, what I'm hoping is that by introducing the State Parks Youth Pass, that we're bringing people to the parks that wouldn't have been there anyway. So absolutely there are people, and I am glad to see that more people are visiting our parks, more than 15 million visitors per year, and that they are an important part of our economy. But there are an awful lot of people that have never stepped foot And that's what I'm hoping to change the direction on.
Let's get into the technical side of the legislation. Now, you're a sponsor, a co-sponsor of this. Who else is on board so far?
Well, we have a bipartisan list of folks that have signed on to the bill, and I just started circulating it a day or so ago, and I look forward to the list growing.
Do you, bipartisan isn't a word we get to say a lot here in Wisconsin in the legislature sometimes. Do you see this as something that that people of both parties could get together and work on?
Well, so far, people of both parties are excited about it. I think, again, many of us that have been born and raised in Wisconsin, many of us that are raising our own children here, understand that this is our legacy. And it is something that brings us a lot of pride, and we want to give that experience to others. And regardless of who it is that you voted for president or governor, I think as a proud Wisconsinite, we need to get more people spending time in our parks. And that starts with passing the state parks youth bill.
Is this headed to a committee, or would this go to a committee, and which one?
So we just introduced it on the 3rd, so we don't have even the full list of sponsors yet. It is available for people to add their names to, and I would encourage your listeners to reach out to their elected officials and encourage them to sign on if this is something that they would like to see happen for the state. And once we have that that window closed, then it will be signed to committee. And I'm hopeful we could have a committee hearing and maybe move this forward yet this session.
And just getting back to that big picture, what do you see for the future of Wisconsin State Parks? What are your hopes?
Well, I certainly hope that my colleagues on both sides of the aisles realize how important it is that we protect and conserve our natural lands. It's definitely a gift that we can be giving to generations that have not yet been born. And it was a gift that, you know, many years ago, when the first state park was created in Wisconsin in 1878, it was a gift that is continuing to give now.
Representative Sargent, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Thank you.
That was Melissa Sargent, Democratic State Representative from Madison, talking about new legislation that she's co-sponsoring, offering free state park passes to fourth graders and their families. Recent arguments in favor of a GOP-led overhaul of Wisconsin's civil service system included a story about a short-order cook who scored well enough on a civil service exam to be included as a finalist for a job as a financial examiner. Spokesperson for the Department of Financial Services indicated that the applicant lacked the necessary skill set, and the whole thing slowed down the process. While no resume or documents or the name of the person have been found or released, the story has been used to make the case that resumes are a better way to gauge aptitude for a job with the state than the current testing system. Our next guest, though, says testing lends itself to a meritocracy, and what's more, he takes issue with the idea that a short-order cook wouldn't have the skills to be a financial examiner. Kyle Cherik is the host of Wisconsin Foodie and an active part of Wisconsin's restaurant scene. Kyle, welcome back to the show.
Thank you. Thank you.
Well, in part, Kyle, you say this anecdote about the short order cook is a slight to restaurant workers. Why do you say that?
Well, it's a sensitive topic for me because I think until the last, say, 20 years in media, cooks and their place in society were not extolled to the level that they are. And if there's dignity in all work, then why isn't there dignity for all workers? I'm not arguing that the short order cook was not ultimately qualified to be a financial analyst. We don't know enough about this person in the long form to know whether he or she was. We just know that they, through the process of the exams, which, by the way, the exams are specific to each position or job or department. So there isn't one civil service exam that everybody takes. If you're looking to be a mail carrier versus a financial analyst versus a someone who works in workforce development, there's different exams that you take. And this person scored high enough to become a finalist and then went to an interview where they found out that there were some other skills that may or may not have been lacking. I actually think that process is fine. The issue that I have is that they're getting rid of the exam process where the best and the brightest may avail themselves, at, you know, a Good Will Hunting situation, if you will. And only allowing for resumes, which I think, well, I don't think, I know, can be trumped up versions of who the person really is. And if we're using that against hardcore data, how do we make that argument for education testing or other types of testing, for instance, to suss out the best and the brightest?
We'll dig more into the restaurant profession in a bit, but let's stay with testing. You'd like to see these tests stay. This is a good idea, you think. Why is that?
I think so because they allow a window into some aptitudes and capabilities and intelligence that you can't make evident on a resume. There are professional resume writing services. There are websites that then folks spend money on to verify that the resumes that were written are, in fact, factual. That in and of itself, and I'm not saying all resumes are dubious by any stretch, but that in and of itself imparts a little bit of showbiz in that you're selling yourself for the position. And I think everybody should. Every time you have an interview or every time you present yourself, you're essentially selling yourself for that position. But let's draw a comparison to test scores and a short-order cook. One of the things that I love about the culinary world is that every cook, chef, general manager even, within 10 minutes on the job, everyone will know whether they have the skills and the acumen that they said they did when they got the job or whether they don't. Let's say kitchens, tool and die shops, and undertakers are one of the few places where your walk has to talk and vice versa.
Right. I could maybe bluff my way through that interview at a restaurant, but a few minutes of watching Rob Ferret cook, the restaurant would probably shut down within an hour.
Right. And that's one of the things, and this is a bit off topic, but that's one of the things that I absolutely adore about the culinary world, is that it is a craft, whether you're a short-order cook or whether you're a Michelin chef. It is a craft, and there's certain skills that translate. There's many skills that translate across all different levels of that craft, and you can't fake them. And I think in tests such as this one for the financial analyst, if this person exhibited certain acumen that led them to be a finalist for a financial analyst, that's a wonderful thing. We might, as a state, I think we will be doing ourselves a disservice by excluding those folks through the test process. And ultimately, we don't know what happened to that applicant. He or she may have ended up in one of the other departments. He or she may have, they might have looked at the scores and said, well, they don't have the people skills or what have you, or the management skills to be an analyst, but they'd be great over here. But Governor Walker and the folks that have looked to change this are doing, in my opinion, and I love to use the short order cook as sort of a tip of the spear for this argument, are making it more inclusive more exclusive and less inclusive.
Talking to Kyle Cherik, host of Wisconsin Foodie, about civil service exams in Wisconsin and the restaurant world and the skills that come out of it. Now, I want to take that second part here, Kyle. What kind of things do people learn in restaurant work that might make valuable skills elsewhere, maybe in management or leadership?
Well, I could go on long form about that, but I think we just look at some of the other folks that have ascended through government. Governor Walker's first job, he proudly states, was at a McDonald's. Senator Ryan, who's now the Speaker of the House, and one of the things that tipped me onto this story that I thought was just a strange coincidence, when this story broke by this terrific reporter, Molly Beck from the Wisconsin State Journal, on the same day, October 29th, that the story broke, the Wisconsin Restaurant Association posted on their Facebook that Paul Ryan is now the Speaker of the House. Congratulations to him. And that his first job was in a restaurant. He also was at a McDonald's. He also drove a Wienermobile. And when the Wienermobile, which I just think is kind of charming, and listening to the Oscar Mayer sad news in the state, we should all, give a pleasant nod towards that old icon. But when he first came to, Congressman Ryan first came to Washington, he was a speechwriter for Bob Caston, and he filled in his income working at Tortilla Coast on Capitol Hill, which some of your news folks might remember was the place that Senator Ted Cruz had the side meeting with some rogue Republicans that didn't work so well with John Boehner when we were last talking about the government shutting down. Tortilla Coast is famous for that reason, too. But clearly, all of these things contributed to those two gentlemen moving forward in the world, creating some skill sets putting money in their pocket. And I can say in all of my time spent in and around restaurants, they can be one of the most productive environments for developing great discipline, team building, accountability, timeliness, excellence in your job. And they're one of the, well, I don't know about few, but they're one of the still great American traditions where, well, I wouldn't even say American, but worldwide traditions where you can start at the bottom as a dishwasher and work your way up to own the restaurant or maitre d' or executive chef. And there are countless stories that I can enumerate that trace exactly that path.
Well, and Kyle, can you make the case for those of us outside of the restaurant world to show a little respect to the short order cook, the McDonald's counter worker, the wait staff at the restaurant, or the people behind the scenes?
I believe that every one of us should have to work in restaurants for at least 6 months at some point in our life, preferably during the younger years. Just as Germany used to have compulsory military service, I believe that if we're ever going to go out to a restaurant, we should have had to work in one, because that experience is so informing, and we treat those folks differently, and everyone does deserve the dignity of doing work. But sadly, there is not yet still dignity for all workers.
Compulsory culinary service. Interesting idea. Kyle, thanks a lot for joining us again.
Delighted. Thank you.
That's Kyle Cherik. He's host of Wisconsin Foodie. You could share your thoughts on the idea if you've ever worked in food service in the restaurant world. Send us a message on the Central Time Facebook page or tweet us at Central Time WPR. Show some love for the restaurant workers there. As you may have realized, this November has been a little warmer than usual so far. For the third day, temperatures creeping into the 70s, at least in parts of the state. Well, it might be a sign of things to come this winter. This year's El Nino, one of the strongest on record, is predicted to have some pretty significant effects on winter across the country. South and East Coast, maybe that means slightly cooler winters. Upper Midwest could mean, and we'll define could in a little bit, a warmer and possibly drier winter. Here with us now to talk about what El Nino is, how it could affect us here in Wisconsin and around the country, is Daniel Vimont. He's Associate Professor of Atmospheric and Oceanic Sciences at UW-Madison. Dan, thanks a lot for joining us.
All right, thanks.
Well, you know, I'll throw around the phrase El Nino and, oh, that weather. Oh, maybe it's El Nino. I don't really know exactly what El Nino is. So what, define it for us. What is an El Nino?
El Nino is a climatic phenomenon that occurs every 3 to 7 years. And we're experiencing one right now. It's a big event this year. And it involves a warming of the tropical Pacific Ocean, especially right along the equator in sort of the middle and the eastern part of the Pacific Ocean. And that warming is on the order of 2 to 4 degrees Celsius, which doesn't seem like much. But in order to get the entire tropical Pacific to warm by that much, it requires a complete reorganization of the entire tropical system, the largest ocean basin on Earth. So this is a huge phenomenon.
3 to 7 years, you said. That doesn't sound regular. So what makes it happen? Do we know what causes 1 year to be El Nino and 2 or 3 other years not to be?
To a certain extent, yes. El Nino gets kicked off usually in, say, March or April or May, sort of the boreal springtime. And there are some patterns that we can kind of recognize that are precursors to El Nino. And what's interesting about this year and last year as well is that we have the same precursor patterns both years. And once it gets kicked off, it may grow into a big one like this year, or if the atmosphere doesn't cooperate, then it may fizzle away. And so last year, even though the conditions were very similar in March and boreal spring, the atmosphere just didn't cooperate. So this year, the atmosphere has cooperated just fine, and we have a whopping event.
And some years we have El Nino. Sometimes we have La Nina. So is that just the opposite, a cooler Pacific?
Yeah. When the tropical Pacific cools, we refer to that as a La Nina event. Or a cold, what we refer to as ENSO, El Nino and the Southern Oscillation, that recognizes that the ocean and the atmosphere both work together to produce these kinds of events.
And some years, I imagine, are neither. They're kind of down the middle.
That's right. Some years we just have neutral conditions.
We're talking to Dan Vimont from UW-Madison, looking at El Nino, a big year for El Nino, this weather pattern, and what it's going to mean for weather around the country. So let's get to that now. What does a big El Nino year like this one do to the weather across the country?
El Nino has a big effect globally, and it does have an effect here in North America and the United States as well. So this huge shift in the tropical Pacific, this rearrangement of ocean water, is also associated with a huge change in where precipitation occurs in the tropical Pacific. And this is just like throwing a rock in a pond, except the pond is the Earth, and the waves that emanate away from it are the jet stream. And so during an El Nino event, what can happen is these waves propagate throughout our atmosphere around the globe and can affect the jet stream and hence the kinds of conditions we may feel in North America. So a couple of the common effects of ENSO, or El Nino, is that the southern U.S. tends to be a little wetter than usual. And this could be good for California if that rain comes it doesn't come all at once. And it usually means a little cooler in the southern U.S. And then around here, and especially in the Pacific Northwest, typically these big El Nino events are associated with drier and warmer conditions.
Now, these are tendencies. You're using the word could, not will. So this is making those conditions more probable than usual, but not a sure thing.
That's a great way of thinking about it. I like thinking about loading the dice. Mm-hmm. So any year could be different than any other year. But when an El Nino comes along, the dice are loaded for warmer conditions in the Midwest. And to put that in perspective, we've really only seen about six really large El Nino events that we have great observations for. And three of those were warmer than usual in the Midwest, and three of those were neutral in the Midwest. So there's not a huge sample size, but there does tend to be a tendency for warmer or at least not colder conditions.
Well, I want to bring things home here to Wisconsin. And by the way, you can join in with your questions, your observations, if you're a weather watcher at home. 800-642-1234 is the number to call. That's 800-642-1234. Oh, we've got Joshua on the line in Wales. Joshua, hi.
Hey, good afternoon. My question is, we have a lake property on Lake Huron over in Michigan and have been dismayed over the last decade to see the water levels dropping, and now they're back up significantly due to, I think, colder winters and less evaporation. Who really knows? But I'm just wondering what you think the El Nino effect will be on the Great Lakes. Will there be less snow in the Lake Superior snow belt and that sort of thing?
Interesting, Joshua. Thanks for that call. Do we have an idea of a causal link between El Nino and what happens to water levels in our Great Lakes?
That's a real tough question. I'm sorry, I'm not going to give you a good answer, Joshua, on this one. What I can say is that in some of the historical events that we've seen, there's been reduced lake ice cover, especially locally, and that can then cause more evaporation. However, I would think that the 1 year event would not have as big of an effect as sort of a long trend or several years where we might see warmer conditions. And I think you're absolutely right in thinking about the evaporation associated with that.
Joshua, thanks for calling and good luck with that property on Lake Huron. Well, let's talk about El Nino and weather in Wisconsin. Given that it's not a direct causal link, El Nino's here, therefore this, what are the other factors that go into the recipe for what a winter is going to be like here in Wisconsin? El Nino and what else?
Well, there's a whole slew of things that can affect us in Wisconsin. We live in a very interesting climate, I think, and that makes it...
That's a very positive way to put it.
That's right. That's right. You know, we like the cold up here, I guess. But it's also very variable. And we saw that a couple of years ago with these polar air outbreaks that we saw in the winter of 2014, where we just had very cold conditions. And actually, last winter was a little little cold as well. El Nino is loading the dice, and in addition to that, we have all the other things that could be affecting our weather, such as these polar air outbreaks or just random chaotic variability in our atmosphere. So while the forecast doesn't mean that every day is going to be like the last couple of days that we've seen here, it is. I do like this idea of loading the dice, where we might get a little warmer on average, but we will still see cold snaps.
Yeah, staying on the topic, or getting back to the topic of ice cover, I think I saw one of your colleagues in your department talking about it was a big El Nino year. I don't remember which year, but you know, where they were throwing rocks into Lake Mendota in February and splashing because there was no ice. Is that, can a sustained serious El Nino lead to a lot less ice cover over the course of a winter?
If it affects the temperature in such a way. And right now is the time when a lot of the heat that is stored in Lake Mendota or Lake Monona, some of the lakes around here, is starting to be lost. And when you get a really warm snap like this, it makes it harder for those lakes to lose that energy, and hence the ice on date, so the day where the lakes freeze over, tends to be a little later.
We're talking to Daniel Vimont, Associate Professor of Atmospheric and Oceanic Sciences at UW-Madison, looking at the effect that this year's strong El Nino is likely to have on weather in Wisconsin and across the country, or maybe the world for that matter, this winter. And you can join in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. What questions do you have about the weather this winter and what El Nino is all about? And are there any sports or activities that you depend on the weather for? Do you want it to be a little colder, or do you not mind maybe a milder winter? Let us know how you feel about the prospect of a warmer, drier winter at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234, or post on the Central Time Facebook page. We're continuing our conversation now with Dan Vimont, Associate Professor of Atmospheric and Oceanic Sciences at UW-Madison, looking at the effect that a strong El Nino is likely to have on us here in Wisconsin and around the world this winter. You could join in with your questions, your observations at 800-642-1234, or post on the Central Time Facebook page. Go right to a caller. We've got Lori on the line in Delafield. Lori, hi.
Hi. I'm just curious, as far as I'm concerned, the worst thing about the last couple of winters has been the polar vortexes that have hung around for so long, and I'm just wondering if we can count on less of that because of El Nino.
Lori, thanks. Dan?
I'm with you, Lori. The cold winters 2 winters ago was a rough one. The relationship between El Nino and the polar vortex, I'd say there's not a strong relationship, but I'm going to go out on a limb here and say that the kind of persistent polar vortex, those cold snaps that we had a couple years ago, are probably not as likely this winter. I think it'll be a little warmer winter than it was then. Those were all of us in the business, and those of us who just experienced that winter. Certainly noticed that those were persistent and just one came after the other. So I think that was a little more unusual. I'm going to go out on a limb and say we're not going to see that this winter.
All right, we'll hope for the best. Lori, thanks for the call. We'll go next to Don in Mount Horeb. Don, hi.
Hi, guys. Well, you've got thousands of cross-country skiers across Wisconsin, and the biggest cross-country ski race in the nation happens in Hayward. And it's in about the middle of February, and we're all just waiting for some sort of a guess. Is the Berkey going to happen this year?
That's good. I actually worked with some of the director of the Berkey Miner as to kind of how they would cope with these kinds of variations and with long-term trends in climate. And the good news is that they have a lot of kind of mechanisms in place where if it is a bad snow year, that they can change the course or they can import snow. And they've done a lot of actually really good work on trail restoration and making sure that if snow does fall, they can kind of keep it on the trail. So what matters a lot is how does the snow season look going up to that, because I'm sure you're going to be training a lot out there. And there's where the news may not be so great. With warmer conditions, we may not see as much snow. But I do want to emphasize that this is, again, rolling the dice on this. But the dice are definitely, unfortunately, weighted out of your favor.
Don, good luck to you and everybody involved with the Berkey. One way or another, the snow must go on, I guess. We had a caller named Greg who couldn't stay on the line. He says he's traveling to Peru this winter, wonders what the effect of El Nino will be like near the equator.
It depends on where you are, and when you're going to Peru, the El Nino has an enormous effect in Peru. Typically, much wetter conditions than they're used to. And in fact, I believe, I'd have to double check this, but I believe Peru has even declared a state of emergency already for potential flooding that occurs during El Nino events. And that's because that warm water in the eastern Pacific is replacing typically cold conditions. So that warm water is associated with a lot of rainfall. That being said, I guess I'd say take your chances on it.
All right. And I imagine in a place like Peru and, of course, California, landslides might be an issue, especially after a long, dry, season, a bunch of years in a place like California. A lot of rain could lead to landslides.
Yeah, especially if that rain comes in deluge, mm-hmm. which it could.
Well, while we're traveling outside of the country, can you talk about some of the impact? There's some big negative impacts of El Nino already around the Pacific.
That's right, and especially over in the western side, so the other end of where Greg's traveling. So Indonesia right now is experiencing massive amounts of fires. And a lot of that is because El Nino causes very dry conditions in that region, and people who are clearing land then use that opportunity to clear a little more than they are regulated to do. And one of the problems with that is that a lot of that land is peat. And so by burning that land, it's releasing a lot of smoke and a lot of carbon dioxide into the atmosphere right now.
We'll go back to our callers now. We've got Heidi on the line in Middleton. Heidi, hi.
Hi there. I have a question about building a backyard ice skating rink. We built one last year very successfully, one small thaw, but January and February were absolutely outstanding for it. I'm wondering if we should bother to go through the effort this year.
Wow. That's a tricky question. I would kind of play it by ear on that. Hopefully you take a look at the long-term forecasts before you flood your rink. There's some great resources available through the National Weather Service and through NOAA, but you might find that you're flooding that thing a little later than usual this winter.
Good luck, Heidi. We're talking weather, Wisconsin, the world, and a big El Nino in the Pacific, how it's going to affect temperatures, precipitation, and all of that with Dan Vimont, Associate Professor of Atmospheric and Oceanic Sciences at UW-Madison. Back to our callers now with Mary in Brookfield. Mary, hi.
Hi, how are you? Dan, I'm calling to ask you something quite literal and rather important. And that is the effect of climate change. And you know, the fact that I don't know if meteorologists address it, or, you know, if much of it is being swept under the carpet and you know, excused as El Nino or whatever. But how much of this do you attribute to climate change, and can you be specific in your answer? And I appreciate it. I'll take my answer off the air here. Thank you.
That's a good question, and you are identifying one of a very important topic for our field right now. I would say that our understanding of how climate change impacts El Nino is kind of in its infancy at this point. There are studies that suggest that El Nino events will become more intense during due to climate change. And there are other studies that show that the impact of El Nino on the global atmosphere will become more intense as well. So a stronger relationship between El Nino and, say, warm weather here or wet weather to the south. That being said, it could take a long time before we're able to distinguish that effect from just the fact that any El Nino event is different than another event. And because these things happen so rarely, it may take us hundreds of years before we're really able to distinguish that the effect from climate change. The one thing I will say here is El Nino has a huge impact on our temperature. And so this year will be, I'm confident that this year will be the warmest year on record globally, just because you think about this warming in the tropical Pacific. It's the biggest ocean basin on Earth. And it's in the tropics, which cover a lot of our globe.
So you've got climate change loading one set of dice, and now we've got El Nino loading another set. So depending on how they roll, it could be a big impact.
It could be, yeah.
Thanks a lot for that call. We'll go next to Greg in Bloomer. Greg, hi.
Hello. Hello, Dan. I'm wondering what the interaction between the blob, the hot water blob in the North Pacific and El Nino might be, if there's any projection on how that might affect Wisconsin.
Greg, thank you for bringing up the blob.
And
which
Dan,
is my...
Greg's out ahead of me. I don't know about this blob.
Okay.
First, tell me what that is, and then talk about the impact of it.
Well, so the last couple of years in the Gulf of Alaska and just west of the Pacific Northwest in the Pacific, we've experienced a really, really warm patch of water. We're talking 3 degrees Celsius warming. This is an enormous amount of warm water that's situated just west of the Pacific Northwest, and it's been referred to as the blob. I think it was initially by a friend of mine, Nick Bond, who we've all kind of colloquially referred to it as the blob of warm water. And so I'm thrilled that this has made it into the general nomenclature here. So I think that the blob has is related to one of the processes that helps kick off El Nino as well. But I would say that the blob itself is probably not causing El Nino to be any stronger. It's just related to a different process that may be causing this. And I think some of the research that we've looked at suggests that the blob may be having an effect on temperature, especially during, say, spring or summer in the Pacific Northwest. Just that much warm water, when you blow air over it and then blow that directly into the Pacific Northwest, you can create some warm conditions. And that's certainly what they've experienced the last couple of summers.
Greg, thanks for bringing that up. We've got David on the line next in Mason. David, hi.
Hey, how's it going?
Good. What'd you want to bring up?
Well, I'm an avid sledder in this area, and typically, you know, 14, you know, everybody was complaining about the cold, and I was just absolutely in heaven because we had so much snow. I'm just hoping we get another year like that, because I got a couple of new sleds that I want to try out.
I'm with you, David. I work on the 11th floor of our building, and I keep hoping that I'll have to enter the building through the windows.
Now, David, but don't you want lots of snow, but maybe milder temperatures?
Well, yeah, but it gets to the point where, you know, you want good base on the trails, you know, and if you get too warm a temperature, then things get spongy and soggy, and things that's don't really freeze up underneath.
Yeah, that's right. So the what you want is the happy medium, where it doesn't get so cold that it doesn't snow, but it stays warm enough that that we get a lot of snow, and but not too warm that it melts. Hopefully, we stay in that sweet spot. I'm with
David. Thanks a lot for that call, Dan. As we wrap up, for better or worse with El Nino, a big El Nino year, it's got to be an exciting time to be in your line of work.
It is. I always feel a little guilty being excited about a giant phenomenon that could actually cause a lot of destruction in some areas, but it is a very interesting phenomenon, and there's a lot we still need to understand about it, and this event is showing us just that.
And is there a turning point where you'll say by the end of December or mid-January, we know, okay, it's this kind of El Nino impact?
That's a good question. I think this winter we'll see the peak of El Nino, and I think during winter is when the impacts are most pronounced, and so at that point we'll have a much better sense for its impact.
Dan, thanks a lot for coming up to the studio.
Thanks a lot. It's been fun.
That's Daniel Vimont, Associate Professor of Atmospheric and Oceanic Sciences at UW-Madison. We've been talking about the effect that a strong El Nino could have on the weather nationwide and in Wisconsin this winter.